Dr. Show!
You have all made it through the dance. You have all made it. Dr. Show!
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 79. I'm your host, John X. Thank you for joining us. Glad to have you back once again. This kicks off a very special week for the John of All Trades podcast and a very special week for Denver. Let's face it, this is an awesome week. It's Denver International Film Fest. That's right. This city has its own film fest. It's in its 38th year and it's awesome. You know why it's awesome? Because it's the first year the John of All Trades podcast has been invited to participate. So, what are we doing? Let's make it special. There was no episode last week. I had some scheduling snafus. So this week, we're going to make it up to you with all sorts of Denver International Film Festival goodness. A new episode every weekday of this week. We're going to have 5 episodes, all focusing on people participating in the Denver International Film Fest. So, the first group, the very first interview I did, this one features Ian Cook and Ian O'Doherty. They're part of a band that falls under the name Ian Cook. You can find them online. It's Ian Cook Music. It's IanCooke. Don't forget the E. IanCookMusic.com. And it's great stuff. It's cello, prog, pop. So super concept albums. So it's things that you can't just listen and dispose of. You're not going to just like take it and then get rid of it. No, that's not what you want to do here. You want to actually absorb their music. Their music is terrific. And this latest album that they have is a concept album and it deals with Mesozoic creatures. I know that sounds weird and maybe it is weird. I don't know. But these guys are such talented musicians and such thoughtful folks that when I was introduced to them through the Denver Film Festival, when I sat down with them, I go, oh man, these guys are awesome. Because Ian Cook and Ian O'Doherty have been together for like 15 years now. And so their insights about how the music industry has changed, you know, why they're writing about Mesozoic creatures, what it means to them. It's so great to talk to artists who are so pure of heart, so pure of intent, and who are putting great things out into the world. So it's a great way to kick off the coverage here at the Denver International Film Festival. So I'm just thrilled to be a part of it. I'm thrilled that Ian Cook and Ian O'Doherty are a part of it. And this is how we start off our coverage. So look for us the rest of the week. You can check us out on iTunes. Every one of these episodes is going to be numbered. All 79 episodes up to this point are available on iTunes. If for whatever reason you don't like that, you can come to our website. It's johnofalltrades.us. That's J-O-N of all trades.us. All the episodes are housed there. And you can read the companion blog pieces. And I encourage you to do that for especially this one, Ian Cook and Ian O'Doherty, because as part of this album that they released, there's also a coloring book that goes with it. And so I took a couple of photos of the coloring book. You can check it out. Ian Cook drew all the photos himself. It's just awesome. So go to the website, download the episode there. You can find it on iTunes. You can also find it on Stitcher. That is live streaming internet radio. It's a great way to enjoy John of All Trades. And you know what? Stick around the rest of the week because I have episodes lined up for the entire week. I've never done this before. 5 episodes in a row. 5 episodes in 5 days. It's a big deal for me. But you know what? Denver International Film Festival is well worth it. I'm proud to be a part of it. So check them out on the web. It's episode 79. Ian Cook, Ian O'Doherty. Go to johnofalltrades.us to learn more about them. Get all the links. Check out the coloring book. And learn more about the Denver International Film Festival. But for now, listen to this episode because it starts right now.
What mattered to you?
What did we talk about? We talked about the Karate Kid.
Oh.
Yeah. What'd you guys talk about?
Dinosaurs.
I talked about Fugazi.
I love Fugazi. Were you big in the DC like punk scene? Like, were you into that?
From here, but yeah, they're my favorite band of all time.
Yeah, no, they're fantastic. I was listening to Lagwagon on the way over here.
Yeah,
so grew up loving punk rock.
Yep, me too.
But so we're sitting here with Ian Cook and Ian O'Doherty, and we're here at the Denver Film Festival. So thanks for being on the show, guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You're here promoting a film, right? A short film. Is it a music video? Is it a film? What? Tell me about your project.
So we did an animated music video for a song called Epilogue off of our new album, which is called Antiqua Soria. And Cook can talk a little bit about the album. But the video is essentially a two-minute animated video that's a summary of the album.
It's the last track on the album, and it's it sort of says goodbye to all the dinosaurs and other prehistoric Mesozoic animals that are featured on the album. Each one gets a song, and then the end, the epilogue is like the, you know, well, the dinosaurs are gone, and now we have the planet, and we're using up all their fossil fuel to survive.
Totally. So is that, I haven't seen the video, because obviously you guys are you premiering it here? Have you showed it anywhere else?
We haven't shown it publicly yet, but it's been seen.
Okay.
But yeah, it'll be interesting to see some public reaction to it.
Yeah, that's always interesting, isn't it? Because I got my master's degree in communication, and what I wrote about was how intent is interesting, and intent can inform a piece, but ultimately, once it's out in the world, it takes on a life of its own. Is that scary for you guys before you release something, or is it something you think about?
Definitely, yeah, a little bit. It's I mean, we're super proud of it, and yeah, Rusty's a brilliant animator, so I'm more excited than scared.
Good. Well, I mean, that's where I'd hope you'd be.
Yes.
Obviously. What has the reaction been to the people who've seen it so far?
What it is, it's felt dinosaur puppets placed within a moving diorama, essentially. Uh-huh. And the moving diorama travels through 100 million years of evolution,
yeah,
as we see what may have been happening at that time. So, you know, at first glance, it's cute,
right,
and kind of, you know, huggable and lovable. But really what it is the story of death. You know, over 100 million years, and that's the only consistent thing. So it certainly has a lot of layers to it. So I don't think anyone's going to think that it's sad from watching it,
right,
but it's certainly thought-provoking because the first half of the video is essentially the dinosaurs that we talk about for the earlier 9 songs on the album, and then the second half of the video is what has happened since dinosaurs were no longer on the planet and humans kind of took over, which has been fire and loss of nature and
right,
trains and big buildings. And and then it ends with, you know, we kind of pull away from this scenario, and the ending is kind of left up to the audience. So the reactions have been mixed, certainly, in terms
sure
of not whether the people like it or not, but just what people take away from it. It's one of those videos you can watch many, many times and get more detail every time. Mm-hmm. There's a very small moment of a group of early human-type forms that are chasing a mammoth, but
right,
the key is that one of them is holding a spear, and then there's a spear stuck in the mammoth. So, you know, the use of tools was certainly a major change in human evolution, but also it was a major change in mammoth de-evolution. There's a lot of hidden stuff in there, and Rusty certainly had a lot of fun taking Cook's lyrics and turning them into something visual. Because a lot of the story is pretty straightforward.
Sure.
This happened and this happened. But he certainly took a lot of liberty with how it was displayed.
Yeah.
He found a lot of new meaning that I never intended in the lyrics that I love.
Yeah.
You know, seeing that what he came up with.
That's always so cool when you create something, because I participated once in the 48-hour film project, and I wrote for the film we ended up making, and one of our actors got a hold of it, and he said, you know, I'm getting kind of a used car salesman vibe from this guy. And I said, wow, I intended him to be like powerful and sort of demanding and, you know, domineering. I go, but you know what? He is kind of just an oily D-bag. And so it, like, when people get some layer that, that maybe you didn't think of consciously, but that's in there and that makes sense. And when it gets back to you, you go, wow, yeah, I didn't even think of that, but that, that is part of what went into it. Is that something that you guys find, when people react not only to this film, but your music? How frequently does that happen, and how does that change how you make music going forward?
That's a tough
kind of a loaded question, yeah, but
I get a lot of sort of reviews from people and what they get out of songs, and it's always interesting to hear that, and I'm glad. I guess I certainly think about crafting lyrics in a way that they're, you know, about a specific thing, but
like some sort of autobiographical
mostly, yeah,
thing, right?
Like just the right amount of vague so that people can apply it to their own situation.
Well, that's the thing about music, right? I mean, it's at once universal and intensely personal.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Which is so amazing, because you hear a song and you go, oh man, something like that happened to me. It won't be exactly, and maybe it's totally different, but you know, everyone has a very personal feeling. And when you're putting out music, that happens with so many different types of people.
Yeah.
That's just so cool.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The very abridged version of Cook's 12-year career was a very personal album about unrequited love. And then the second album, using a lot of those same feelings and themes, but in case of one song that we also did a music video for, using animals to express human themes. It was a song about a flying mammal, a fruit bat, mm-hmm. that falls in love with a flightless bird. Mm-hmm. And so using, you know, human feelings and animals to kind of portray them. So this album is then a further step in that direction, where it's just about animals directly. And the emotion that's in the songs is that of a Mesozoic era creature,
right?
And maybe not as easily transferable to modern day times, but it's still survival. Mm-hmm. And it's still being thirsty and, mm-hmm. you know, being threatened. And I think, yeah, the progression of the three albums kind of tells a similar story. It's, you know, basic human emotions told through various vessels.
Yeah. What led to, okay, first of all, a question about how you decide to do a music video for a particular song. Are there songs that lend themselves to, you go, okay, this is a great song, and it would lend itself visually to something interesting? Or, I mean, in that sense, do music videos almost sort of choose themselves? Or do you have an eye towards that when you're making music ever?
I feel like I've always been interested in scoring films and influenced a lot by film scores.
Do you have any favorite film scores before we go on?
Yeah, I guess. Oh, there's so many. I mean, John Williams is great. You know, he's
iconic.
King of that, yeah. I guess there's more TV that I'm interested in. Battlestar Galactica. Bear McCreary is the musician for that, and he does Walking Dead and a few other shows that whenever I hear of a show that he's been involved with, I want to watch it just so I can hear the
that's so cool
soundtrack. But
the Batman composer,
Shirley Walker is one, and she kind of took Danny Elfman's Batman theme and repurposed it a little bit for an animated Batman movie.
Cool.
And I don't know, there's a ton, but I hear that a lot from people, you know, your music is so cinematic, picturing landscapes when I listen to it or whatever.
Right.
So I have that in mind, but I'm not set out to, you know, make sound for an image.
In the case of this album, it's really modeled after a couple things. Gustav Holst's The Planets, you know, a piece of music per planet, but more 70s progressive rock albums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Genesis, King Crimson, yes, all that kind of stuff, where the album is the format, not the song.
Oh, interesting.
And so this was written as an album. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's in chronological order. And again, the song that the video is for is the last song, which is a summary. It's the epilogue to the story. So it was a no-brainer to have that be the music video, because it's...
Sure.
On one, it's just the most poppy, certainly, song on the album, but it's... it's kind of like the curtain call in a standard musical where the whole cast comes back out and they wave. And so in our case, in a musical sense, each dinosaur has its melody brought back and a little line or two from its song all come back to reappear in the final verse of Epilogue. So everybody kind of gets their moment again. And
it's like a big mashup.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
And so it was an easy and obvious choice visually, because then we could use all the dinosaurs instead of focusing on one story.
Yeah. When you mentioned that this was intended as an album, and you know, it's chronological and it tells a story and it's meant to be consumed in that way. Is it challenging creating a piece of art like that in this day and age where everything seems, I mean, people talk about the death of the album all the time. And so everything is singles or mashups, or if you go to any dance club, they'll play like 30 seconds of a song. With sort of that being the general trend of culture, is it more difficult for people to sort of come to something like that? Or is it's different, it's sort of differentness, is that a potential selling point?
Yeah, we deliberately ignore all those rules.
Good.
The first album was also a concept album, and the second album we tried to do kind of the song thing and wrote a song specifically to be a single.
Right.
Modeled after another specific song. So, but this album, was back to the album concept, and everyone in the band plays in other bands. And so between us, we've done lots of concept albums by this point over the past 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of where we're at. None of us listen to singles. We listen to albums.
Yeah. Has the trend of people getting back into vinyl, is that helpful momentum for you guys? Do you guys release on vinyl?
Yeah.
We do, yeah.
Cool.
We have the past two albums on vinyl, and we keep talking about re-releasing the first one, thinking that sales might be good.
Right, totally.
I've never stopped since, you know, we were talking about, before this interview started, talking about punk bands in the 90s, I've been releasing vinyl since then and never stopped.
That's awesome.
So the fact that it's popular now is good and bad. It's great because, you know, merch sales are up slightly and people buy records. I think more like they buy t-shirts. It's more of a souvenir often than a listening device. Mm-hmm. When it is a listening device, that's great, because that's really ultimately what we want, is for people to just sit down and listen with no distractions.
Yeah.
Another reason that that the album format is preferred over the song format for this concept is we want people to stop their life for 40 minutes and check out this piece of art, you know, rather than in their car while they're checking their phone or as they're cooking dinner or whatever. It's we want this to be the focus. So on that note, there's a coloring book that comes with the album.
Yeah. I'm looking at it right here.
We did a surround mix for the whole album. So as the album plays on the DVD, there's lyrics and time-lapse video of the coloring book.
Oh, cool.
Playing it. So it's meant to be a whole experience that you take on, you know, just that. Back to the vinyl conversation, the other important thing about all this is that vinyl is made of oil. It's PVC, you know?
Yeah.
And it's dinosaur blood.
It's
detritus from the era, and there couldn't be a better musical format to sell this album on than vinyl. I mean, black vinyl is virgin vinyl, and it's the closest we can get to buying a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Other than, I guess, buying a barrel of crude oil.
Right.
And so with the album, it's also released on amber vinyl. So a little Jurassic Park reference with that.
Cool, yeah.
So it's either, you know, translucent amber or black vinyl. And so same thing. The large format is better for the art. We can fit the coloring book inside the record sleeve and
totally
get the whole package. So it's a 360-degree project.
Yeah, boy. You know, it's funny. Listening to you describe it, you want people to sort of consume it, you know, consume the whole thing. What you're describing is almost akin to the way people consume a movie or they consume a book. You know, and I would say that runs counter to how a lot of people consume music, because in some ways we get music all the time, whether it's the Muzak in the department store or like you're in your car, or I mean, there's ambient music playing right now.
Sure. Yeah.
Does that make it a tougher sell, or does that even matter? Or does that, in some cases, make it an easier sell?
It's a tough sell. It's been very challenging to market this album. We thought it would be easy. Oh, you know, adult album about dinosaurs.
Right.
The idea, Cook's original idea was to do a dinosaur album that has nothing to do with Barney or Rafi or any kind of existing children's music, to make a legitimate piece of art about, and we should, I should stop saying dinosaurs. It's Mesozoic creatures, because there's non-dinosaur creatures that the album is about also. If we're going to be accurate here.
Yes.
Right.
But yeah, my frustration at all the music about dinosaurs being sort of kid oriented is what sparked this whole project. So
what is it about dinosaurs and Mesozoic creatures that compelled you to write an entire album about them?
I don't know. I guess I've always been a enthusiast, and my parents have taken me to the Natural History Museum.
I was there yesterday with my daughter.
Nice. Yeah, from an early age, just being exposed to those awesome skeletons that I still go in there and, like, look up at the Diplodocus and cry, because it's just amazing to know that these things walked around. And I don't know. I didn't lose whatever most people do.
Yeah. You never lost the sense of wonder towards it, right?
Yeah.
But what you're describing is most of our sort of cultural understanding, particularly as it pertains to music, is we've almost infantilized dinosaurs, right? and so this album, without having heard it, you're it's almost like you're trying to elevate the discourse around them. Is that accurate?
Sure.
Am I reaching?
Yeah, I could go with that.
Yeah. As he said, on one level, he just thinks that they're cool. And
well,
just wanted to write a bunch of songs about dinosaurs. On the other level, back to the oil discussion, just briefly, you know, everything in our society is either oil or plastic, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
So, you know, we're surrounded by them, and we kind of ignore that they existed. And, you know, a lot of our classical arts are struggling now. Ballet, orchestras, museums, theater, it's all struggling in the, you know, current times. And so one of our goals is to, you know, kind of change that, and we want people to go to the museum, we want people to talk about these things and to recognize that we're still surrounded by the remnants of dinosaurs, depending on what you believe. Of course, there's other beliefs in this world, but
depending on your belief system, dinosaurs were either around, what, 6,000 years ago or 65 million years ago, right?
Exactly.
Right. I tend to believe it's in the millions, but certainly not going to begrudge anyone who that's not what we're here to do.
Well, and for anyone, I think dinosaurs represent similar to the same thing that dragons and unicorns represent, which are both fictional, of course, but it's interesting because right now the museum has an exhibit on mythical creatures, right?
Yeah.
So it's a strange place that we're in when the Natural History Museum has a mythical creatures exhibit, which was preceded by the Sherlock Holmes exhibit.
Which, is there now, actually, as well.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so,
that's right, yeah. Sherlock Holmes just started because we went yesterday and looked at Poison.
Oh, okay,
cool.
Yep.
Yeah, and so that was a really cool one. But, the Sherlock Holmes exhibit, it's exactly what you're describing. He's a fictional character.
Right.
And then, you know, you talk about mythical creatures as well. Kind of strange.
It's a strange place to be in the Natural History Museum. So I guess one of the perspectives of the album is we have these fantastic creatures that are not fantasy. They're real.
Right.
I mean, they did exist, and they existed right where we are now. And, in fact, Colorado has a very rich, rich history of paleontology.
Absolutely.
So the first song in the album, Stegosaurus, was discovered just, 15 minutes from where we are right now.
That's our state dinosaur, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a state fossil. Cool. 1877, right? It was discovered.
Yeah, and something like that.
From then on, for the next 20, 25 years, it was like the gold rush, but the dinosaur rush. You know, it was a dinosaur boom. Mm-hmm. Just right on the ridge from here up to South Dakota, there were hundreds and hundreds of species were discovered.
Yeah.
And where we are here was ocean.
Yeah, the interior Cretaceous Seaway.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think people forget these things, and they just think, oh, that used to be a 7-Eleven, and now it's a Taco Bell.
Right. Now, go back a little further.
Go back a little further, and there's a lot more interesting history going on. Red Rocks was the origin of Stegosaurus, and Diplodocus, and Allosaurus, and many, many, many others.
Yeah, when you go up on that hogback, there's so much there. And, like, when you go to the top, one of the things that most surprises people is beach sand.
Yeah.
Because I grew up not far from there. Uh-huh. I grew up in Applewood, and then I moved up to Genesee. So so many of our field trips were there, and cool. You'd see the footprints, and you go up there in beach sand, and you know, you find out that Colorado was once beachfront property. Uh-huh. You're right. I mean, going back to, you know, before it was a 7-Eleven, before any of us were here. And, you know, it's also what one of the things that has contributed to why we have abundant oil and gas resources in this state as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It has to do with that seaway. And then as it got buried, you know, you're absolutely right. So the fact that you guys are shedding a light on this in this way is just so cool because it ties into so much that we take for granted. I like the idea that you're not creating something to be consumed and then immediately disposed of.
Sure.
Which some of the pop music you hear, you go, oh, that's fun, but it's like cotton candy. Mm-hmm. Right? This is a little bit more sort of, it's there and you want to feel it. So that's really cool. So as far as the sound of your music, though, I saw you describe your band as, is it cello prog pop?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a term we came up for a tour I went on that we made posters for the venues wanted to promote. So
sure.
Just to describe, you know, try to explain to potential attendees
right
what they're in for. Yeah.
Your popsicle term was kind of better, though.
Oh, yeah. My friend Shenandoah Davis, another musician, she's in Seattle, she came up with the genre popsicle, pop and classical.
Nice.
Together. So that was kind of the
and who doesn't love popsicles?
Yeah.
So, I mean, really. How would you describe, like, so cello, prog pop, popsicle. If someone hadn't heard your music before, how would you say, like, if you like this, you'll love us?
Mm. Queen is a very... It's our first go-to, I would say.
Well, you mentioned concept albums, you know, Day at the Races, yeah, Night at the Opera. Sure. Oh, yeah.
Totally. I grew up with a lot of that, and ABBA, and
Bach.
Bach, yeah, lots of classical stuff. Sure. Obviously, learning cello, you're forced to go through the
standards, right?
The history of classical music, yeah.
People often say Fiona Apple.
Cool.
Bjork. Mm-hmm. Cook is heavily influenced by Joanna Newsom, a harpist.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Queen and ABBA are, I think, most frequently.
In the reviews of your music, I heard a lot of reviewers made comparisons to Sufjan Stevens.
Oh, sure.
Is that fair?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Definitely.
How long have you guys been a band?
It's a strange... The short version of the story is I started a different band with Whit Sibley, who plays bass in this band, in 93. And in 2001, and that band was called Apollo. In 2001, Cook joined Apollo.
Cool.
In 2004, he started writing his song specifically for his own name. In 2007, first album came out. And so from 2007 to now, it's the same band. Became called Ian Cook.
Oh, cool. All right.
Or Ian Cook Band. So
you guys have been together, though, almost 15 years?
15 years. Yeah. We've known each other and have been playing music together, in various projects, because there's been others besides those two as well.
In that time, every few months you'll read a think piece about the death of the music industry, right?
Sure.
And you guys have been together for as long as you have. How has the business changed since when you started to how it is now?
Yeah, it's... So Apollo started in the 90s punk rock world.
Were you guys in Denver?
Uh-huh.
And so
we were playing shows with, locally, Crestfallen and Pinhead Circus and
Pinhead
Boss
Circus
302, all those bands.
Pinhead Circus came out of my high school.
Oh, okay. Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, so I love those guys.
Yep. So we were, in that realm initially, and then later we're playing shows with Fugazi and Blonde Redhead and Hot Water Music and, more of the two-guitar Fugazi thing.
Sure.
And then later we're playing shows with Decemberists and Head in the Heart and Lumineers and Paperbird. So our genres have kind of shifted over the years. And so I don't know. The music business has changed dramatically, but really, in a lot of ways, it hasn't changed at all. Mm-hmm. We're still a tiny, tiny business... doing things DIY. We do everything ourselves in the same way that I did when I was 15, really.
Yeah.
You know, Fugazi and Discord taught me everything I know about life, really. And
are you good pals with Jason Heller?
Oh, yeah.
Because he was on the show.
Yeah.
Nice. Oh, okay.
He was episode 16. And so
Jason actually was in Apollo for a very short time and
cool.
has written several articles on us and really turned us on to a lot of the music that we were listening to in the beginning. New stuff that we hadn't heard, he would say, oh, hey, you got to check out this album. So, yeah, Jason was actually instrumental in our career in a lot of ways.
That's awesome. I actually, just to interrupt real quick, I bought a Crestfallen record like 6 months ago at Twist and Shout. I saw it in there and I go, holy shit, I have to have this.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I haven't heard these guys in a long time. And to have it on vinyl was just so cool.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
They were a big deal to us because they were our friends, but they played regular venues. And that before that, we didn't really make the connection that we could just play a regular venue. We thought we could only play at the high school or at our friend's house. We started extremely young.
Right.
I was 13 when we started playing shows and stuff. So
wow.
A lot of the shows were kind of us opening for our older brother's bands or that kind of thing.
Sure.
And then we realized, oh, we can actually just play clubs and bars and play music for real. And Crestfallen is what taught us that.
Oh, that's cool.
So, you know, we're still doing everything ourselves. Cook drew the coloring book himself. The font he designed. And
you drew this yourself?
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
So the font was a thing he also just drew, and then we had someone convert it into a usable font, so it's actually part of the download as well. The origami CD case Cook designed, and we fold everyone
wow.
by hand. Everything's the video, we made all the dinosaurs by ourselves. You know, it's stop motion, so it was...
How long did that take?
It took 3 or 4 months for Rusty to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we do everything ourselves for many, many reasons, but...
Well, sure.
In that sense, nothing has changed in 20 years. Mm-hmm. But lots of change, things have changed, of course.
Yeah. We've evolved from playing in those clubs you were talking about to... We realized that this kind of music that we make isn't really for the drinking, talking crowd. So
yeah.
We definitely aim for obscure, fancier venues, you know, art galleries and proper theaters where you sit down
sure.
and listen, and those are harder to find these days now, but
and much more expensive.
Yeah,
yeah,
and
sure.
much more expensive to deal with. But
yeah,
about that,
just
sure.
yeah, making big fewer shows and making them bigger, and yeah, more of an event, and yeah, we recently got to play with the Colorado Symphony backing us up, and that was a...
Wow. That had to be a rush.
Pretty exciting show, yeah. They have this program called Turnover the Keys, where they take, offer their services to local bands, and they've worked with Devotchka and...
Oh, Devotchka's great.
The Fray, and like all,
yeah.
a bunch of the...
Paperbird.
Paperbird,
nice.
Yeah, Colorado bands that are doing quite
oh.
well, and
sorry,
or
not Paperbird.
Not
I'm
Paperbird,
sorry,
yeah. But yeah, so we feel very lucky to have been the guinea pigs for this program.
Yeah, no, definitely. And how frequently are you guys on tour?
Cook tours quite a bit solo.
Okay.
Yeah, I try to go out maybe like 2 weeks at a time, a couple times a year, out to LA and back, out to New York and back, just to keep myself in their brains.
Yeah, stay top of mind, of course. One of the things, whenever I talk to a comedian, or I interviewed a pro wrestler at one point, and cool. so you have these groups of people, comedians, musicians, wrestlers, anyone, a salesman. I know a guy who's on the road probably 75% of the time in different territories, and they all kind of say the same thing. I've traveled the world but haven't seen a thing.
Hmm.
Is that sort of true in your experience? I mean, what, and a different question, what would you tell someone who hasn't traveled a lot or who hasn't been on tour? What is it like that they may not realize or may not expect?
I think there is a lot of, most of the time there's the like, okay, hurry up and get to the next place
yeah.
mentality. And I think, to make a really streamlined, efficient tour, you would think you'd want a gig every night that you're out, but I've found that I have a camper van that I sleep in, so that solves a lot of problems, you know, trying to find a place to stay. And then a gym membership at 24 Hour Fitness, so you can go shower. But I like having, you know, a show booked and then 2 or 3 days off, so I can get to the next town leisurely, see the tourist attractions I want to see, and then get there in enough time to play at an open mic night in that town to promote the show and just kind of make some friends and figure out. I've met so many people who will say, you know, oh, well, next time you come back to this town, you got to play at this place.
Yeah.
You got to, here's my friend Chad's email. He'll set you up or whatever. And
cool.
I think just having that extra time constantly is really advantageous.
Ian, what about you? We'll go to the other Ian.
Tour advice. Drink a lot of water. Don't drink a lot of alcohol. Don't eat at gas stations. And roll your clothes. Don't fold them.
Why is that?
They stay non-wrinkled easier. Yeah.
Wow. Roll the clothes, don't fold them.
Yeah.
I used to be on the road a lot for work. I never did that. I probably should have.
Yeah. I think, yeah, generally you always pack a lot less than you think on the road.
Yeah,
my goal on the road is always to get up early and see stuff. Go to the museum, even if it's for a few hours. It's so much more interesting than sleeping in. And, you know, the standard person, I think, stays up really late, drinks way too much, sleeps in way too late, and is late everywhere and gets sick. Everybody gets sick on tour.
Sure.
And that's the main reason for eating healthy and drinking a lot of water is it's just a miserable time to be in a van sick on tour. Yeah. And then you get everybody else sick.
Yeah.
And so
and then everyone's miserable, right?
Yeah. I've done too many tours, and yeah, that's the thing. Healthy eating and lots of water.
Is it tough to eat healthy on the road? Because I know that when sometimes I'll be in flyover country in particular, there's not always the most healthy options available easily.
Yeah.
Is that a challenge?
It's extremely hard, especially in the U.S. I mean, traveling in Europe is much easier for a lot of reasons. But
right.
Yeah, the U.S. is just the whole highway system is geared towards terrible food and gas stations.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right.
I think it's best to avoid that as often as possible. Wake up an hour earlier so you can actually have like a sit-down meal.
Right.
I think is the way to get around that. So you're not hurrying and eating the breakfast burrito at 7-Eleven or whatever.
Right. Are you guys better about that, having done this for as long as you have then? Is that something you sort of learn along the way? And do most bands, most musicians kind of trend that way the longer you go at it?
Yeah, I think there's always two groups. There's some people who think that, touring is like a nonstop party. And
like they got to be Motley Crue or something?
Yeah, and those are the people who don't last.
Yeah.
In that band, you know, those are the people who get kicked out of bands.
Right.
And those are the people who don't last with the lifestyle because it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
In this band's case, the other two guys have kids and stuff, and so it's a lot harder for them to get out. So we've only done, I don't know, 10 or 20 shows as a band out of state where Cook has done, you know,
a lot.
Hundreds or something.
Sure.
Yeah. So for the band to go out, it has to be a bigger money thing, and we try and, you know, group stuff together so it makes sense financially. But the other thing that is pretty unique about Cook is live solo, he uses a loop pedal. So he samples himself live and loops layers of himself. So he can be like a band and keep all the money and own, you know,
right.
Doesn't have to pay a band. He can just have a pedal to replace us. So it's a much better touring vessel, really.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny listening to you guys talk about this, and something I'm struck by in almost everyone I've interviewed. First of all, to be a professional musician, you got to not suck, right? I mean, that's sort of a number one. Make sure you have your craft as dialed in as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that no one tells you, and the thing that they don't tell you about any job, is that you're going to have to learn and pick up all these other skills along the way.
Oh, man.
It's crazy. Listening to you talk about, you know, going to an open mic, networking there. My friend Chad, he owns this place. Go here. That's all stuff that's not necessarily intuitive. You go, I'm going to make some music. People will come watch it.
Right, yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
<It doesn't. laughs>
Was it difficult figuring out how to do this? I mean, once you decide you're going to be in a band and you're good and you go, we got something here. Like, this is us. We want to play. What is the process like of acquiring all those other skills?
I think it actually goes back to your question about what's changed in the past 20 years
in music. For most other people, not including us, what has changed is traditionally the record label did a lot more in the past. Mm-hmm. The record labels that still exist don't really function in the same way that they used to. Now you need a booking agent, a publicist, a music placement company.
And they're not all under the same banner?
A manager.
Wow.
And a record label. So between 5 and 7 different arms to your octopus or whatever. Whereas in the back in the day, you'd have a manager and a record label and a booking agent.
Okay.
So the things that have, the publicity has been added. People use music placement services to get, it's pay to play, basically.
Yeah.
Everything is kind of payola now, where it used to be against the law. Now it's standard and it's expensive. So many things are on a fee, a percentage basis. Like a booking agent will take 15% of every show. But a lot of things are on a flat basis. So you pay $3,000 a month for 3 to 6 months for a publicity package if you're going to put out an album or do a tour
or
a campaign. So the trick is now your manager hopefully can sync up all these different entities to coalesce at the right time at the album release.
Yeah, to get maximum sort of juice out of it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Which is near impossible now to book a tour at the same time that a record comes out because vinyl manufacturing times have changed dramatically. It used to be you could get a record done in a month. Now it's more like 5 months.
Really?
Because of the enormous popularity of records and no more pressing plants existing, it's kind of collapsed the whole industry. I mean, that's why it's really rare now when digital, CD, and records all come out the same day.
Huh.
A lot of times you'll see digital and CDs come out, and then 3 months later the records, cross the finish line. It's because it takes forever to manufacture it.
Yeah.
So to sync up all those processes is a nearly impossible feat, and to do that you need a manager kind of wrangling 5 or 6 different entities. And, of course, you're paying for all that stuff.
Yeah.
In different ways. And so it's become a lot more challenging, and basically everyone kind of realized that you don't get anything for free, so you're paying for everything. There's no such thing as free publicity, Back in the day, it'd be a poster on a wall, and now you're paying for click impressions on social media sites, or you're paying for a banner ad to be in a certain blog or whatever. I mean, everything is paid for.
Well, even an interview like this, you guys are paying with your time.
Yeah.
There's an opportunity cost to that. Now, granted, this is a way for people to really get to know you. I love this format. And it's a way to sort of understand where you're coming from and learn more about you. And I think you developed great affinity with potential audience members in a format like this. But, I mean, this is an hour where you guys can't be doing something else. Mm. You know? So that's kind of weird. But the point is, I really appreciate it.
we do too.
Well, I mentioned all those things, and we take part in almost none of that.
What we take part in is
real connections. At least we hope to. We said, we want people to sit and listen to it. We want to sit and talk to people. We want people to experience Cook's cello playing and singing directly. So he does a lot of library gigs and art galleries and high schools and orchestra classes and stuff to have a direct interaction with kids usually, but also he played a couple shows at Folsom State Prison.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
To have direct interaction with people who care, because for those audiences, it's not 10 seconds of a song as you're flipping through Facebook.
Right.
It's an event, It's a moment to sit and listen. Mm-hmm. So we try and make things organic and real still.
Yeah, it's funny. It's got to be hard. 5 months to get a record pressed. And in that time, I mean, I imagine you've got to be touring. You've got to be making money. And so, wow, what a tough balancing act to do. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. And I don't think that would occur to most people, especially since music is everywhere.
Sure.
It's like, oh, it just comes out. Would you guys record this yesterday? Right?
So this album was several years of making. Let's see. Well,
yeah, like three, late, I guess.
Yeah,
we were sick of all the songs by the time the album was out.
Yeah.
There's a song on the album called Quetzalcoatlus, which is the largest flying creature yet discovered.
Yeah.
similar to a giraffe when standing, but more like a glider
wow.
when flying. Roughly 30 to 40 foot wingspan, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this song was mentioned in a different, excuse me, this animal was mentioned in a different song on the previous album. Because of that, Cook said, oh, I want to write a song about this beast. And in conjunction with that, he built a costume.
Cool.
Yeah, I've Halloween is hands down my favorite annual event.
Mine too.
And one of the reasons being there are multiple opportunities to win thousands of dollars for amazing costumes, which is another one of my favorite things to do is build costumes. So I made this.
So is Halloween a revenue stream for you?
Yeah, definitely. Nice, cool. I just won $2,000 with my boyfriend. We went to tracks and were dressed as kind of minotaur, Arctic minotaurs, I guess. I was a muskox and he was a caribou.
Yeah.
And we had our jumping stilts and we made our paper mache masks and used a bunch of fake fur, and it was a lot of fun. That's, it was a lot of work.
That sounds amazing.
Worth it.
Yeah, and I don't know that I've ever met anyone who views their Halloween costume as a potential money-making opportunity. Yeah. That's awesome.
So that was not the first time he'd won the $2,000 costume contest.
Yeah, so the other, in, I guess it was 2013,
right.
I made this this Quetzalcoatlus quad stilt suit that I have crutches on both my arms and legs.
Yeah.
And
oh my God, you turned that into a costume?
Like a hiker's backpack that supported a fifth crutch going up above my head, making the neck of the, you know, sort of giraffe-shaped thing. And it ended up being, I guess, like 12, maybe 12 feet tall. So we brought it into the venue in pieces and assembled it, and
what was it like to wear?
It's a workout to to move around in it.
Because each limb is on a stilt.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So, you know, all four limbs are elevated. And
yeah.
It's challenging to walk in.
But, yeah, so far, I think of all the bandmates worn it.
Sean never
Maybe
has.
Not Sean.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Sean's got to get on it, then.
Yeah.
Right?
It's challenging. It's a core workout, but it also puts a lot of pressure on the balls of your feet.
Yeah.
So it's like a interesting core workout and calves and ankles and stuff all at the same time. And
wow.
And, visibility is challenging because the human head is basically in the chest of this pterosaur.
Yeah. Yeah.
We were going somewhere else before we started talking about Halloween. But that was a brilliant digression.
Costumes being, that's kind of another source of income for me.
Right.
In addition to, you know, playing weddings and whatever else there is along the way that fits in the schedule.
Yeah.
And so what we've done, we're working on our second collaboration now with a modern dance company called Wonderbound. And that has also become a source of creativity, but also of money. And a couple of years ago, we did a full dance production with them. And so right now, actually, right before this interview, we had a meeting with them and a band called Chimney Choir. We're doing a stage production of Queen and Bowie songs.
Nice.
With a narrative, a dance narrative to it. So
cool.
Right now, that's what we're actually working on for a February production. So we're buried in Queen harmonies and more Queen harmonies, stacks and stacks of vocals and guitars. So, but immediately after that, this Antiquasoria project is going to come full circle because we're doing a stage production of the album.
Wow!
So that costume is going to be one of many that are currently being built for a stage production. So back to the whole thing of we want to play in theaters where people are sitting and listening, and this is an event akin to a opera or a theater performance. The album will be presented live with costumes and other visual representation of the lyrics. So we have a dinosaur building team working right now on frames and legs and heads and everything. Basically mimicking the style that Cook used to build the Quetzalcoatlus costume.
Mm-hmm. That sounds amazing. Are you guys going to tour that? Are you going to house it like in a theater? Or Do you have plans for that yet?
We haven't really thought about what happens after the initial performance, but
we don't have the patience to do it forever because we all want to do the next project already, sure. And we're all already busy, and you know, we're booked for a long, long time.
Yeah. Good. Well, and that's a nice problem to have, right?
So it certainly makes sense once we're going to build all these costumes to then take it out on the road and have it be a stage production elsewhere. But we don't really know how to do that logistically yet because we don't really want to do that for the next year or two.
You know,
we want to do another thing. So we'll see. We'll definitely do a handful of performances here and we'll see what happens. You know, we don't really know yet. In terms of venues, we're still looking because the beasts are huge. And we need huge ceilings and a huge backstage area.
Wow.
And it's a very specific venue we're looking for.
I haven't found it yet.
No. Mm-hmm. Dvochka's doing a stage production of Sweeney Todd. And so ours will hopefully be immediately after theirs.
Cool. Yeah.
And they're using DCPA venues.
Hopefully there's a theater in that complex that we can figure out how do we use, but
that's awesome.
That's what we're working on right now. Yeah, is that, and that'll be for May 2016. So we're quite a ways off from that, but at the same time, we're freaking out because it's coming up. It's coming up.
Yeah, that time is relentless. But first, here at the Denver Film Festival, you guys need to premiere Epilogue, right?
Yeah.
When is that happening?
Monday at 6:45. And Tuesday at 9:15, I believe, are the two
PM
music
both
video.
Times?
Yes,
cool.
Yeah.
Both music at the C Film Center.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, this I think is going to come out on Monday. So if you're listening to this today, the day it comes out, head over there, check it out at 6:45, and then Tuesday 9:15. Where can people find more out about you guys? Where can they find the album? Now's the time in the show when you can plug anything you want. So please do so.
Cool. The website is iancookmusic.com, I-A-N-C-O-O-K-E, music. And, yeah, we got our Facebook and our Instagrams and all that business.
The album is available at all local record stores in Denver. It's
awesome.
Available on Amazon. It's iTunes. It's in England. It's kind of wherever you want to find it. You can find it in Antiqua Soria. Is spelled a little bit like the word antique and then the word Soria, like dinosaur.
Oh, yeah.
So, meaning
ancient lizards.
Awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, guys. This was an enormous thrill for me. It was really a pleasure to meet you guys. And good luck at the Film Fest, and then continued success to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And that wraps up episode 79 of the John of All Trades podcast with Ian Cook and Ian O'Doherty. Their film, Epilogue, is playing at the Denver International Film Festival both today and tomorrow, Monday and Tuesday, so be sure to check that out. Find out all about the Denver International Film Festival on the John of All Trades website. That's JONofAllTrades.us. Everything you could want to know about this episode, about these guys, about the film festival, will all be right there. So, it's kind of your one-stop shop, much like 4Degrees, who is the proud sponsor of the John of All Trades podcast, is your one-stop shop for all the internet campaigns you could ever want to run, regardless of whether or not you're trying to reach constituents or consumers for whatever consumer product you are producing. 4Degrees is the place to do it. So check them out. Number 4DEGRE.ES. They are the proud sponsor of the John of All Trades podcast, and they do great work. This is a production of Deft Communications, Denver-based content, marketing, and engagement. Check us out on the web, deftcom.us. We got more coming this week. 5 episodes in 5 days. It's never been done before on the John of All Trades podcast, but the Denver International Film Festival deserves it. So, we will see you back tomorrow. How about that? And until we see you then, say goodnight, Gracie.